I'm Chris Wright, and welcome to this week's very special edition of Right on the Nail. Because today I'm joined by one very special guest to discuss world politics and, let's be honest, the mess the world seems to be in right now. Richard Spencer. Richard is the China correspondent at The Times, but was the Middle East correspondent from 2016 until recently, and has been covering the war in Gaza since the Hamas attack on Israel on the 7th of October. He was previously news editor, China correspondent, Middle East correspondent, and Middle East editor at the Daily Telegraph. So he is well versed in knowing about exactly what's happening in the world and how it's going to affect us all going forward. And it sure is affecting us all right now. But first of all, Richard, you've had a very, very interesting career. What was your first posting abroad? And which other countries have you worked in or work from over the time that you've been doing this kind of journalism?
Sure. So I first went to work abroad. I mean, I had worked abroad, if you like, in passing, but my first posting abroad, it was quite late compared to quite a lot of my colleagues who tend to start a bit earlier and specialize earlier. I went to China in my mid-30s. I began covering the Communist Party Congress of the People's Republic in China in 2002, and I lived there for 7 years. And then I went on to the Middle East. So those are, the Middle East and China have been my real two areas of specialism and expertise. I actually have a degree in Middle East studies. And while I lived in the Middle East, I lived in Dubai, I lived in Cairo, and I lived in Beirut. So a very disparate bunch of Arab capitals. I was very much covering the Arab side of things, if you like, rather than the Israel-Palestine conflict. But of course, in those years, those were very big years for the Arab world. You had the Dubai financial crisis in 2009, which I always mention because it was kind of much more important, I think, than just a side effect of the global financial crisis. But then, of course, you had the Arab Spring and everything that flowed from that, the breakdown of order and life in general in places like Syria and Libya and Iraq, and interesting, very challenging, and very grim as well.
Do you speak any of the local languages, like Mandarin or any Arabic languages?
Yeah, I'm pretty crappy at languages, I have to say. I did learn Mandarin, and I can get by in Mandarin. My Arabic was rudimentary. I can read Arabic a bit, but wouldn't like to conduct interviews in Arabic. I have to say, I always used a translator. Of course, many journalists, even if they do speak the language, do use local journalists and local translators and local fixers to act as guides and intermediaries and researchers wherever they are, because you know, particularly in quite difficult environments, as has been the case in the Middle East, and quite alien environments like in China, where they're not really used to foreigners, or certainly weren't when I arrived more than 20 years ago, in a lot of places in China, you really did need a local person to help you anyway. But language is not my strong point, I have to say. But I say I could get around in Mandarin, which that's a fun language to learn, but very difficult.
It is very difficult. Quite an accolade that you can get around in Mandarin. I think I would struggle. Beirut, now, obviously you weren't in Beirut back in the 60s, 70s, at the time that Kim Philby was hiding there. It must have been a very strange place to be in those days, Beirut, when it was almost at the forefront of Anglo-American Russian espionage and all of that was going on at the time.
It was. I was just reading a great book that came out a couple of years ago about Kim Philby's days in Beirut and the extraordinary machinations that went on, at the time of his defection to the Soviet Union. And, you know, it's a mixture of the smoke and mirrors world of espionage and alcoholism. It's an extraordinary time to be alive, I think, particularly if you were British, with the sort of fading of empire and no one really quite sure whether they were important or not. Beirut itself is no longer that place. I mean, it had the civil war, which kind of completely destroyed it. It's still living in the shadow of that civil war. It's rebuilt, but then, you know, fallen into a massive financial crisis since then. The rest of the Arab world has actually become somewhat more open, or until the Arab Spring it had. So, you know, that idea of having a sort of sophisticated, westernized base in a otherwise hostile Middle East isn't quite the same anymore. So not that I know very much about that world. There are easier places for the spooks to hang out in now. Beirut itself, its infrastructure doesn't really sustain the sort of surveillance technology that is now such an integral part of that. You know, the big spy base in the Middle East is now Cyprus. Actually, that's where a lot of monitoring is done on over the airwaves.
Really, is that right? Because there's quite a lot of Russians in Cyprus as well. I mean, I never went to Beirut, not in those days, not since. But I did, actually, I do know Kim Philby's daughter, who was married to a now deceased long-term music publisher in London. So we used to sort of see her socially for a while, but it was all very strange. Anyway, more about that, and we'll talk about China a bit later as well. But let's talk about what's happening in Gaza and what's happening with the conflict with Israel. Now, I mean, we are in whichever side of the equation you're on, we are surely in a real mess here from a humanitarian standpoint and from a political standpoint and in terms of how the US and the UK government handle it. And we saw in the House of Commons how the parties are all desperately keen to be on the right side of history here, but they don't even know how to achieve that. So what exactly is going on, and how is this ever going to be resolved? I mean, I think that's what we really want to know. What is the ultimate resolution to this, and will that be an ultimate resolution or just be kicking the ball into the long grass, you know, whilst people take a step back and then start all over again?
Yeah, they're all very good questions. And it is an incredibly difficult, obviously, also quite unpleasant, threatening and murderous conflict. I mean, there is an official version, which I think we all sign up to, actually. Everyone in any sort of mainstream political position, both in Israel and in the West, you know, all the main parties ultimately subscribe to, which is that at the end of the day, some means have to be found for the Israeli people, the predominantly Jewish population of Israel, and the Palestinians to live alongside each other in some way in the area that is now referred to as Israel and the Palestinian territories. The obvious, at the end of the day, solution sooner or later is that you have a Palestinian in a state and an Israeli state living alongside each other. So that is, again, the formal position of most Western governments, of the UN, and in fact, not just most Western governments, most governments. The question is how to get there when an increasing number of people on both sides don't actually believe in that themselves, and the level of hatred on both sides is so huge. So when you look at actually what will happen, you know, there are really grim options. I mean, you know, one option is that at some stage, Israel, which has a, you know, much more powerful military and is fairly ruthless, as we have seen, in how it treats the Palestinian side when there is a conflict, at some point, you know, they just drive out Palestinians from those territories and effectively take control of the West Bank, at least. Gaza is a slightly different case in the way they have of East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, where they now have annexed those places into Israel. Now, I think the assumption from most sides is that that would be so politically unacceptable to the rest of the world that Israel would never dare to do that. And America, which is the sort of guarantor of Israel's security in many ways, wouldn't allow that, and that would be just too much. But there's, you know, the situation changes over the time in the Middle East exchange. I mean, you know, those very big questions, you know, actually change quite fast. I mean, those annexations have happened in my lifetime. You know, those sort of shifts in actual statehood normally take much longer to work out. And so there are ways you could imagine that happening. Likewise, there are also ways that you can imagine Israel disappearing. I mean, until a few years ago, I'd have said that was now inconceivable. Israel was so secure in its boundaries, so militarily secure, so economically successful now, had, you know, increasing relations even with former enemies in the Arab world. Countries that had never recognized it before in the Gulf were recognizing it. You'd think that was, you know, Israel was totally secure. But you can see ways following this conflict where the younger populations around the world, who seem to be universally much more pro-Palestinian than their parents, gradually lose sympathy for Israel. And that's then regarded as a threat by Israel. It may overstep the mark in some terrible way, or perhaps the other side would happen, that the Palestinians would start getting stronger, getting more support. Young Israelis would start to feel threatened and start to seek sanctuary elsewhere again, leave Israel, see it as not a safe place for the futures of them and their families. And suddenly Israel would be, its existence would be threatened. Now, I've thought of quite a lot about this because people always ask me, you know, what is the end state? And, you know, you can see circumstances which both those eventualities get closer. The trouble is that for either of those eventualities to actually come into place requires almost certainly such horrendous warfare, such horrendous massacres, such horrendous, you know, upheaval in the region that it's almost unimaginable. And, you know, I know that people look at what's happening in Gaza and say, well, that's unimaginable. And it is for that very small enclave. But if you multiply that sort of conflict that we're seeing there over the whole area of Israel and Palestine, then you get some sort of idea of what could be faced. So I think, again, you know, mainstream opinion on all political sides has to say, you know, this is what we have to stop. This is where it stops. People are saying this, you know, looking at Gaza and say, right, okay, it's been getting worse for 20 years, essentially since the breakdown of the sort of Oslo Accords, which almost created a permanent solution in the 90s. Things have got so much worse now that surely at this point we have to say this far and no further, and we have to, you know, we have to say that this is the nadir and we have to go up from here into some sort of longer term solution. But, you know, hard to see how to get from here to that solution that we think that decent people want.
Well, if Israel destroys the entire infrastructure in Gaza, which it looks like if they carry on, there will be no infrastructure left. What is supposed to happen to the 2 million Palestinians who currently live there?
They will live very, very miserable lives. But, you know, we do have a precedent for this now. I mean, again, really horrific. But what America and Britain and their allies, along with ground forces, did in parts of Iraq and Syria are not dissimilar. There's a whole separate issue, if you like, about the morality of those campaigns and whether the destruction on the ground was necessary to get rid of ISIS. But it certainly happened. So, you know, that sort of proportions we're seeing is exactly what happened in West Mosul, for example, in Raqqa. When I went to Raqqa at the end of, you know, when ISIS were driven out of Raqqa, you know, I was there the day the last ISIS fighters left, and the next day I had a full tour of what was left of Raqqa. And I've never seen anything like it. I mean, I think they later said, somebody assessed that 80% of the entire 80% of buildings in the city have been entirely destroyed, mostly by the US Air Force and the RAF and other air forces, a lot by artillery as well, but mostly by aerial bombardment. And yet, when I went back a couple of years later, you know, there were shops, yeah, there were restaurants, there were schools reopening. People living in abject circumstances, and that'll be the case in Gaza for years to come.
But you can regenerate, even if you're living in abject circumstances, you can regenerate to the point where there is roof and shelter and a shop of some description, and presumably medical supplies of some description, despite the fact that the total infrastructure gets wiped out in the conflict.
That can happen. It's just, in Iraq and Syria, you know, you were talking about societies that had already been devastated by war, and so if you drive to Raqqa, you're driving through other towns and cities over, you know, hundreds of miles that have been destroyed or damaged, and even the functioning towns that were less badly affected by the war in Syria are poor and badly affected. The difference in Gaza is you've got this astonishing contrast between, say, Tel Aviv, which, you know, is a bustling, prosperous city full of expensive restaurants, beaches where, you know, people sunbathing, a society that you can sense is at war, but is still a prosperous, thriving society. And then literally within an hour's drive and in normal, if the roads were open, these scenes of utter destruction. And that's a very striking, it's hard to say what it, put it into words, really. It's just, it's kind of a moral affront, if you like, without wishing to sort of, you know, of itself judge the Israeli action or the Hamas action or anything. Just in itself, it feels like a moral affront to have that sort of extraordinary contrast in the modern world, you know, that you know, one side of the fence you've got bombed out buildings, hospitals bombed, people living in the streets in tents, and on the other side you've got people dropping, you know, $100 a head on a nice restaurant meal of a weekend and then going to the cinema. You know, it feels very dystopian.
To what extent do you think, in terms of Europe and the United States, and we saw in the House of Commons this week in the UK that the way that people are very nervous about exactly how to voice their concerns over the situation. We see it in America, that certainly as big a supporter as the US is traditionally of Israel, certainly in Michigan, a state that Joe Biden has to win if he's going to retain the presidency, there is a significant Muslim population there, and Michigan seems to be drifting away from him. And people are very concerned. I wonder where you feel the general public in, say, let's just say the UK and the USA are in terms of this conflict, and the extent to which political decisions made in London and Washington are going to be determined by the reading of where the public are deemed to be.
Yeah, I think this is a real problem for President Biden. It's a problem for the left in Britain too, but of a slightly different kind and a different order as well. I mean, we saw last night there was this strange debate in the House of Commons, which descended into uproar over a Labour amendment on the ceasefire calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The way that amendment was written. For President Biden in America, it's very clear. It's a very striking issue. You know, America has been overwhelmingly pro-Israel throughout its history. Not always to the same extent, a bit of up and down, but America's support was absolutely crucial to the actual foundation of Israel in the 1940s. It has a very strong pro-Israel lobby. It has there's a religious aspect to it too, in that the Christian right in America has always been very pro-Israel. And, that applied historically to both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in somewhat different ways. But what you're now seeing emerge in the Democratic Party is a very significant split, again, partly based on age, where particularly younger and certainly more, radical members of the Democratic Party. I use radical loosely because, you know, obviously, the politics are so different with Britain that, you know, that very sort of what we would think as mainstream center-left people come over as, or, you know, described as radical in America. But certainly there's this huge faction now in the Democratic Party, still probably a minority, but very significant minority, that are opposed to America's strong support for Israel. They want America to be far more critical of Israel, possibly to suspend arms sales to Israel, certainly to punish Israel in some sense for the severity of its response in Gaza. And that's a significant part of the Democratic support base, feels like that. And you also have got a growing, small but growing Muslim population in America. In Michigan, that's where a lot of the Arab population of America is. There's a town called Dearborn, which it's sort of outside Chicago, which it has a very strong Arab presence. And that's a very noisy lobby now inside the Democratic Party, or, you know, certainly inside the progressive movement as a whole. And as you say, you know, a lot of those people are saying don't vote for Biden, just as a protest, which ironically would, you know, possibly help give the election to Trump, who is, of course, has a record of very, in his presidency, of being very pro-Israel, of giving Netanyahu and the Israeli government then a lot of what it wanted in terms of diplomatic recognition, moved the American embassy to Jerusalem, which was a very significant move, took a much firmer stance against Iran. So that might be the ironic result of this split in the Democratic Party, because Biden can't afford to move too much, you know, looking at it in purely, you know, in terms of electoral politics. Biden can't afford to move too much away from his traditional support for Israel, because that's still where most Americans overall lie. But he does need to take account this growing hostility from a growing number of pro-Palestinian people. In Britain, it's feeding into Labour's problems, such as they are, in a different way, because it's become about the culture wars in Britain. You know, that the right in the Conservative Party and in Reform and in the sort of populist nationalist right in Britain, particularly online, is portraying the rise in pro-Palestinian feeling in Britain as not being motivated just by the horror of what they've seen in Gaza, but as a reflection of the, you know, the growing Muslim population here, that it's seen as a sort of, been a lot of attempts by, you know, right-wing figures in Britain to portray the Muslim population as anti-Semitic, as somehow not representing British values of tolerance towards its Jewish population, and trying to change its political positioning. And, you know, Labour is coming under attack from the right on that, even though, you know, in my experience, there is much greater sympathy for the Palestinian cause among conservatives than, say, in the Republican Party in America. It seems to me that the parties are much less divided on this in terms of actual, you know, practicalities of who you support than a lot of people think. You know, there are a lot of Tories who are very upset with what Israel is doing. Some of the traditional support base for the Arab world and the Palestinian cause is quite right wing, is associated to other right wing causes, which is exact opposite of America. And meanwhile, of course, you know, Labour has historic ties with Zionism, with Israel. The Jewish populations of North London and Manchester were often closely involved with the Labour movement. So that divide is actually in overt terms, not is in, you know, historic terms, and is not so clear in Britain, but still Labour does have this issue of trying to balance the young pro-Palestinian rhetoric of its young, particularly its younger support base, and particularly obviously its Muslim support base, and most Muslims in Britain have voted Labour in general elections, to as I say, it's you know, the broader attempt by both parties historically to maintain a sort of consistent balanced position towards Israel and the Palestinian cause, broadly, you know, maintaining good relations with Israel and varied relations with Arab states, those pro-Palestinian factions in the Labour Party, the ranging from, you know, quite mainstream Labour supporters to the Corbynite left, you know, really do want Britain and the Labour Party to break those links with Israel and really change the attitude of their policy, the Labour Party policy, and presumably from later this year, the government's policy when it becomes a Labour government, which people expect, to Israel. So that is a real quandary for the Labour Party.
Mm. I mean, obviously, people were completely shocked and devastated by what happened on October 7 when the whole thing started. But I think it's the level of the response that concerns people. But it's very difficult to express your concern about that without being accused of being in any way anti-Semitic, which is crazy. I mean, getting to that point, I mean, even inside Israel itself, how much are the public supporting Netanyahu and how much of the public there are saying, hang on a minute, you know, we're not looking good on the world stage. There's got to be another way of resolving this. The way it's going is not, it might be good from a military standpoint, but in the bigger picture, it's not good.
I mean, the big problem with this whole crisis, and it's a problem that's getting worse and worse. It was already getting worse. This round of the conflict has really rubbed it home. Is that there are just two narratives. You know, there are two totally different narratives depending on which side you're on. You're not, you know, there's you know, if you look at Russia, Ukraine, you know, there's an argument about, you know, the historic relationship between Russia and Ukraine, where, you know, the Ukrainian side, you know, stress Ukraine's independence from Russia, and the differences between Ukrainian culture and language and religion and history from the Russian version. But they're still arguing about the same thing, you know, with Israel and the Palestinians. They're arguing about two totally separate things. The Palestinians are arguing about essentially about civilian losses. The argument has been for years now about Palestinian losses and the failure of Israel to allow and the world to enable the formation of a Palestinian state. Those are the two things that Palestinians talk about. Israel talks about the threat that Palestinian militancy and other forms of militancy, but particularly Palestinian militancy backed by Iran, have to the state of Israel. And the sporadic, often very unpleasant, and often unpleasant in a way that has terrible resonances for Israel in terms of the Holocaust and so on, that Israel has to suffer. If you try as an outsider to say to either side, you know, we have to find some way of balancing this debate, finding some way through, with a lot of people on both sides, you just get a totally blank look. You know, sure, people will say, yeah, it's terrible that so many Palestinian civilians are getting killed. And then they'll just go back to their own narrative of what happened on October 7th, the atrocities that Israelis suffered, the mass murder, the brutality of what happened on that day, and they will relate it to other previous Palestinian atrocities, terrorist attacks, plane hijackings, you know, the Second Intifada, when militant Palestinian groups were, you know, putting bombs in nightclubs and at bus stops. They will go straight back to that discourse. If you ask the Palestinians about October the 7th, they'll say one of two things. I say, why do you always ask us to, you know, about atrocities? You know, don't you see that we've suffered much more? We've lost our land. We've lost our country. We lose far more people in terms of total numbers in every round of conflict than the Israelis do. Or they will say, yes, that was terrible. That was awful. I don't approve of that. Don't agree with that. But look what's happened since. And they will go straight back to the mass civilian casualties, the mass bombing, how that relates to previous mass bombing, the displaced people. They will refer to every other war when Palestinians were displaced, going right back to the foundation of Israel in 1948, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were forced into exile. So you just have two totally separate narratives. And that applies in Britain amongst their supporters, above all applies in Palestine and Israel. So the actual what's happening on the ground in Gaza, you know, it is featured in Israeli television broadcasts, but it's really a side issue for them. They're still talking about the fate of the hostages, understandably, though the hostages are still being kept. They're still talking about, you know, if you read Israeli newspapers, they're still talking about, they're still interviewing people about their experiences of October the 7th. The op-ed writers are writing, you know, about what October the 7th means to them. Only a few of the radical, the more left-wing papers are really looking at what's happening in Gaza and what that might mean. And then only as a part of the broader conversation. It's not the main focus as it is in international coverage now.
So are you saying that in Israel itself, the public are to some extent oblivious to the fact that throughout the rest of the world, there is a growing concern that the response has now got to the point where it's become over the top?
Yeah, I think it's both sides think the world is against them anyway. I mean, you know, it's very hard to tell either Israelis or Palestinians that the world would sympathize with them if they stop doing X, Y, or Z. You know, in the Palestinian case, if they stop supporting Hamas and other militant groups that are happy to inflict civilian casualties as part of their occasional, you know, forays into aggressive conflict. Israel, if they, you know, were prepared to be more sympathetic to Palestinian aspirations and less, as we see it, you know, extreme in its response when it is threatened or attacked, as it was, you know, they just say, well, you'll never support us. So, you know, you're in Israel, they just say, well, you know, the very fact that you don't support us is shows you're anti-Semitic, and the very fact you're asking these questions show you're against the state of Israel. Britain was always against the state of Israel. Everyone's always against the state of Israel. So we don't need to take lessons from you. We just have to look out for ourselves. We just have to defend ourselves. Nothing we do will satisfy you. And the Palestinians say, you know, every approach we've tried, and we did the Oslo Peace Accords. You know, the Palestinian Authority is still at peace with Israel in theory. I mean, there's a lot of hostile rhetoric, but the Palestinian Authority has recognized Israel, has said it will work towards a peaceful settlement of the conflict, which allows the state of Israel to exist and flourish. Israel still hasn't stopped the settlements. It still hasn't stopped attacking us. It still treats us as if we are enemies. You know, both sides think there's not much point in compromise with the outside world because the outside world doesn't support them. And again, that's partly because of this issue of narratives. You know, to engage with us now, you have to accept our narrative and stop listening to the other side's narrative. And that's a non-starter. So where do we go?
Well, where do we go? I mean, is there any chance of there ever being a Palestine state? Should there be a Palestine state? And if there was to be one, what would it look like?
Yeah, so if you look at the wording of what Israel says about this, it's very subtle. Now, Netanyahu, who's been the dominant figure in Israeli politics really for a quarter of a century now, who first became prime minister in 1996, he's been in and out of power, but in power for much longer than he's been out of power during that time. And he actually boasts that he is the man who stopped the formation of a Palestinian state. His argument is that a Palestinian state would be used as a staging ground for a future attack, or at least undermining of the state of Israel, that it wouldn't be a permanent solution, that the Palestinians and their backers in places like Iran would use that as a stepping stone to a next round assault on the Israeli state and its existence. You know, at times that was not the majority position in Israel, and certainly at times opposition parties like the Labour Party were prepared to envisage a Palestinian state. But with every round of conflict in recent years, that sentiment in Israel has drifted away. But they're still very careful in most cases not to rule it out forever. So the Israeli parliament this week passed a vote saying we will not be dictated to on the formation of a Palestinian state. And most MPs in the Knesset, in the parliament, voted for that, including opposition parties. However, you know, that wasn't quite the statement. You know, it wasn't Netanyahu saying, you know, I'm going to hold a vote on a Palestinian state, and three quarters of MPs saying we will not have a Palestinian state. It was stated as we will not be bullied and we will not be pressured by other countries, meaning America and other Western allies, into allowing a Palestinian state against our will. That's still the, you know, the that still has to be considered the likely endpoint of any negotiation. And, you know, when it comes to negotiations, Netanyahu has always played a very hard game. He's never really been interested in negotiating compromises. He's used negotiations to get advantages for Israel with non-specific commitments on the other side that he hasn't really given him anything that he's had to live up to. So, you know, he got the recognition of Arab states like the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. They thought they were going to get a better deal for the Palestinians out of it in some way, but they never did. Nothing happened on that front. Now I think that's changing. I don't think other countries, I don't think Saudi Arabia, for example, will do a deal with Israel unless it has something more concrete by the way of a promise over a Palestinian state. And I think other parties, including parties that are represented by, you know, Benny Gantz, for example, the former chief of staff who's now in the army chief of staff, who's now in the war cabinet, you know, they're also quite hard line, and they've certainly voted for this motion saying no Palestinian state under duress. And Benny Gantz himself has said he's opposed to a Palestinian state now. But they are much more prepared to talk to America to try and move towards a less confrontational position for Israel. And it's hard to see how that happens without a Palestinian state being on the table. It's in some form, you know, however slowly and piecemeal you get to a Palestinian state and whatever powers a Palestinian state has, which will not be full sovereign powers in the sense that Britain has sovereign powers, at least for a very long time. But at some point, that has to be on the table, I think. Otherwise, you do get to this situation where, you know, the only other solution is for Israel to basically run an apartheid state where it's controlling the West Bank in many ways, but the West Bank Palestinians don't really have full rights as you and I understand them, or the other way around, where you know, some other solution is proposed which downgrades the Israeli state. You know, it's the two-state solution is kind of the only thing on the table that doesn't look utterly repellent to everybody.
What is the difference between a Palestinian state and 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza?
So that's a very good question. It's one Israel would ask, saying, well, we pulled out of Gaza in 2005. We left you to get on with it. You could have built a functioning, flourishing, peace-loving territory there. You know, it wasn't our fault. You then voted to put Hamas in power, and Hamas took over and carried on threatening us and, you know, attacking us and all the rest of it. The Palestinians say, well, the big difference is the blockade. So Israel and Egypt combined to very heavily control all access into the Gaza Strip by land and sea. There's no airport. There was talk of an airport at one stage, but that was effectively stopped by Israel after the Hamas takeover, to put it that in context. And the Palestinians would say, well, we were never really allowed to build a state because we never had control of our own borders. We didn't have the right to trade and travel freely. And anyway, Gaza was only ever going to be part of a state or entity that included the West Bank, and Israel controlled all travel between Gaza and the West Bank for Palestinians. So they certainly didn't have the chance to build a state as other countries do, but that's partly due, and that's partly geographic, partly because of the conflict with Israel. And, you know, obviously the Israelis are to some extent correct, partly because of the choices that their political leadership made. You know, they could have argued for better access to money and trade via Israel, which almost completely surrounds them, and via Egypt, which controls the other bit of the border, in return for, you know, more moderate positions on its part. And it didn't. Hamas chose against that. So it's not an easy question, and it's not one that, in my view, makes either side look good.
I mean, in theory, you could build an airport. You could build a port. and you could open up access at the south end of Gaza. But how many Palestinians live in the West Bank then, if the West Bank is a key component to this?
Yeah, so it's about twice as many people live in the West Bank as in Gaza. It's
really?
More populous.
Really? I didn't realize that.
It's and it's a generally, you know, even in times of tension, it's a more relaxed place. I mean, it's got several medium-sized cities, Ramallah, the capital, obviously, cities that we know the names of well from history books, Nablus, Hebron, Jericho, Bethlehem. And so big sense of population. Jenin is another city that's been a particular flashpoint. It's got a very big, what we call a refugee camp. It's kind of a weird, it sounds weird in context, because of course there are only Palestinians living there, but an area that was set aside for Palestinian refugees from the State of Israel at its foundation. And that's a very militant town. So there's a lot of clashes there between the Israeli security forces and locals, but they have a certain amount of autonomy for civilian affairs. There was actually at one point quite a lot of investment. So Ramallah looks much more prosperous than any city in Gaza, for example. And it's quite easy to travel there compared to Gaza. I mean, I can just get a taxi from Jerusalem and drive to any city in the West Bank and go and have coffee with friends and go to restaurants. And, you know, it feels a bit more normal. I mean, there are checkpoints. Those checkpoints often hold up traffic for a couple of hours. That's a risk if you try and do that. You know, getting back to Jerusalem, last time I did that, I was, you know, in a traffic jam at a checkpoint for 3 hours. But, you know, by and large, it's a bit more functional. You don't have to get a special permit to go there or anything as a foreigner. And it's more prosperous, much more prosperous than Gaza was. So that's the peace dividend, if you like. The Palestinian Authority recognizes Israel. They cooperate together on some security issues, on tax collecting, for example. A certain amount of customs tax is collected by Israel and then passed back to the Palestinians, because Israel has control of all the customs points with surrounding places like Jordan, for example. So and stuff going through the airports, which are all in Israel. So there's a cooperation there. It's a more functional zone. Pretty stressed at the moment, though. What we politically call the West Bank is all Palestinian. But what you do have now is these settler towns, which administratively are run directly by Israel. So they are effectively part of Israel. They elect MPs to the Israeli parliament. They are Israeli citizens. Their schools and hospitals are run by the Israeli authorities. I can't remember the exact number. I think the last time I read the numbers of Israeli settlers, it was it had gone north of 700,000. Quite a lot of those are in the areas just inside the West Bank. Some there are also settlements in areas of, for example, East Jerusalem that is annexed by Israel. So Israel considers these settlements as just straightforwardly part of Israel, but the international community has not recognized that. They still regard East Jerusalem as occupied territory. It has a historical separate status because it was never officially part of Palestinian territories either. Jerusalem was always going to be an issue that was going to be where sovereignty was going to be decided at some final peace settlement. So East Jerusalem has a slightly separate status, but certainly the annexation of East Jerusalem is not recognized by other countries. So there are a lot of Israelis living geographically in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Their status is not quite the same as the West Bank proper, if you like, which is all Palestinian, mostly Muslim, some a significant Christian minority, a few Druze. There are Druze and there are Samaritans and one or two other kind of smaller sects, but mainly Arab-speaking Palestinians.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So let's move on, if we can, Richard, from one conflict that the more we talk, I see no real exit route from, no real ultimate solution, to another conflict, and briefly that in the Ukraine. What exactly is your take on what's going to happen there? And how damaging were Trump's remarks in terms of the funding of NATO And in general, the Republican stance on coming up with more funding for Ukraine through Congress in terms of making Putin think that he's not ultimately going to win this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible thought, particularly given how everyone for seemingly for years now has been talking about the decline of America and the declining relevance of America to the world. I don't think there's anything in the world that depends more than the Ukraine conflict on the outcome of the American election. The war's pretty stalemated at the moment. Russia's making advances this year in the last few months, but not significant ones that are significant enough to really threaten the sort of overall takeover of Ukraine that was threatened right at the beginning of the war, and suffering huge casualties in doing so. So, and Ukraine's attempt at a counteroffensive in the summer didn't really work. Last summer didn't really work. So there's a sort of stalemate. And you can see under Biden, you know, he'd carry on arming Ukraine if he could. The war might move to a less intensive pattern, but I don't think Ukraine would come to a deal that just surrendered all that territory that it's lost to Russia. And I don't think Russia would significantly withdraw at this point. So you can see that war going on. If Trump came to power, if Trump won the election, you know, you've got a very different situation where he is openly saying he would negotiate with Putin for a settlement. He is threatening to stop American arms supplies to Ukraine. Europe claims that it would carry on supporting Ukraine anyway, but unless it really ramps up its production of arms, I don't think it's going to be able to provide enough to keep Ukraine going, or to be confident that it can keep going. I think Ukraine will want to keep going. So I think there would be much greater moves towards a ceasefire, at least, that would be in Russia's favor. But you can see other things happening, because Trump is a very unpredictable character. And you can also see a situation where he decides to do a deal with Putin, and then, you know, he decides that Putin's being difficult and storms off and says, I'm not having anything to do with this guy anymore. You know, he kind of did that with Syria when he came to when he took the White House first time. You know, he campaigned on ending America's involvement in foreign wars and overseas wars, and Syria in particular. He kind of suggested that Obama shouldn't have got involved in Syria, even as much as he did. You know, not that he got very involved in Syria until he, you know, led the anti-ISIS war. And Trump said, look at me, I'm the great negotiator, I'm the deal maker, I can knock heads together. And then he was faced with the reality of Assad, and it was Trump rather than Obama who actually ordered the bombing of sites in Syria. You know, the US bombed Syria for the first time under Trump's leadership. So you can imagine that it wouldn't necessarily be a straight line. It wouldn't be necessarily, oh, Trump will come to power and make peace in Ukraine. You know, anything could happen if Trump comes to power. That's the one thing we know. And he will, of course, find negotiating with Putin much harder than he thinks he will. But I think it looks pretty grim for Ukraine in terms of support from the West if Trump gets office. What happens thereafter is hard to predict. But if Biden wins, I think we'll just see a continuation of this stalemate for possibly a number of years.
If you're looking at it from Putin's standpoint, what constitutes a deal that he would be very happy to accept right now in terms of possessions and land and territory?
Yeah, so I think the possessions and lands and territories are important, but not that important to him at the moment, in the sense that, you know, he wouldn't at this stage, because he's, you know, he's not on the back foot, he's not losing territory. He wouldn't offer to give up territory or significant territory as a matter of principle, but he might offer to give up some, you know, in return for a deal. But that would depend on what else was being offered. And to use the cliche, it's a jigsaw with moving parts, because what he wouldn't want is for a deal which saw him still maintaining a foothold in eastern Ukraine, certainly those two areas, Donetsk and Luhansk, the Donbass, which, you know, started with which the war was about from 2014. And presumably he wouldn't give up Mariupol and those southeastern cities. There might be a deal to be done in other areas, who knows? But he wouldn't do that if Ukraine was allowed to join NATO and the EU. That would be such a defeat for him if Ukraine was allowed to join NATO, that such a symbolic failure for his whole strategy, especially now that Sweden and Finland are joining NATO as a result of this war. I don't think he could tolerate that politically. in terms of his prestige and standing at home. So I think that will be the main stumbling block, because I think Ukraine thinks it should get something out of this in terms of its relations with the West. And it effectively is now, you know, a fully-fledged part of the Western alliance. I mean, we all know Ukraine much better than we did 5 years ago. And Ukrainians know the West much better than it did. You know, there are many more personal connections, many more businesses are becoming aware of Ukraine. Many more Ukrainian businesses have become aware of how they can work via Poland, you know, its big neighbor, which is booming at the moment, in general terms, has been booming for the last few years. You know, those sort of linkages are very important now, and that, you know, you can see Western Ukraine becoming more and more integrated, if there is peace, into the thriving countries of Central Europe, like Poland and Germany and so on beyond. So, you know, I think Putin would be thinking in those terms. And I think the West, in terms of what they think, the Europeans will be thinking in terms of what it means for the Baltic states and other countries that feel threatened by Russia. And so whatever Trump thinks, I think they will be feeding very strongly through NATO into any peace talks about that. They don't want to see Ukraine come to a dishonorable or semi-honorable peace with Putin, only for Putin to turn around and say, yeah, Estonia, now it's your turn, you know. So there are many moving parts there, which is why I think Trump will not find it as easy to make a deal as he thinks it will, if he listens at all to other NATO members.
Maybe Moldova and Transnistria as well, and that's always another potential. But for Putin, I imagine that what you're saying is that Ukraine joining the EU and NATO is a red line, and that if he had a commitment that Ukraine could never join the EU and NATO, then maybe he'd give them back a bit of the territory that they've been fighting over, as long as he kept the Crimea and the port on the Black Sea. Can you see him doing that, or do you think he wants more than that?
Yeah, and I think he might be open to something like that. He kind of said he was open to that right at the beginning. I think that's just a non-starter now for Ukraine. Ukraine somehow has to be reassured that it's not going to do a peace deal with Russia, and in 5-10 years' time, it starts all over again. So Ukraine won't do a deal. You know, I think we'd rather go down fighting than do a deal that gives it a false sense of security.
And finally, and briefly, is China and Taiwan next, or can we have a little bit of respite from these wars?
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about the possibility of war over Taiwan by 2027. I just think you've seen a bit of a dialing down of the rhetoric from China recently. When I talk to Chinese diplomats, they keep mentioning the communique number 2, which is a particular document that was signed to maintain an ambiguous status quo between America and China in terms of how America and Taiwan represented themselves to each other and to China. It's sort of, you know, we won't disturb the status quo if you won't, sort of thing, which prevents Taiwan declaring independence, which is a symbolic act, but, you know, also allows America to give diplomatic support to Taiwan. So I think I'm less kind of concerned about that. I know it's sort of all connected, but, you know, you're more concerned about the arms race in the Pacific more generally, where, you know, America sees the Pacific as pretty much its backyard. It's its own sea. It has freedom of movement for its navy pretty much over the whole Pacific. Quite a lot of the countries, obviously, bordering the Pacific and the West are close allies of America, Japan, South Korea, and so on. And China is trying to say, hang on, that's no longer sustainable. You know, we are now a major power. The Pacific is ours as much as yours. In fact, more ours, because it's our only, you know, it's our only coastline. You've got the Atlantic as well. So you've seen China start to build massive naval groups, submarines, advanced warships It now has its third aircraft carrier on the way. So that's a major challenge. Not very much really apart from Taiwan, but a challenge for dominance of the Pacific is underway. And that obviously in the longer term, you know, is destabilizing to many of those countries, many of those fast developing countries, and in some cases very already developed and but quite small nations sort of trapped between China and America in that way. So that's kind of an uncomfortable position for a very populous and important part of the world to find itself in. So that broader issue is quite concerning. I think even though Taiwan is the flashpoint for that, you know, I think that's dialed down a bit still there, though. And, you know, who knows what future leaders will do, you know, of both America and China.
Well, at least it is one crumb of comfort that maybe the Taiwan situation isn't quite as exposed as we thought, even though the Pacific in general could be the next, let's say, battleground, but not necessarily battleground. Anyway, Richard, fantastic. I think we've nailed it. You've been listening to Right on the Nail with me, Chris Wright. We all know a lot more about the conflict in the Middle East and in the Ukraine and the potential conflicts in the Pacific than we did before we listened to brilliant analysis of the situation. So thank you to Richard Spencer, a fantastic journalist for The Times, currently China and formerly Middle East correspondent. And obviously you can find out more of Richard's work on The Times website. If you're enjoying the podcast and you haven't already done so, please follow us and leave a 5-star rating on your podcast app. The podcast is produced by Tom Platts at soundsapien.com and published by New Thinking. Thank you all once again for listening. Thank you especially for Richard for his fantastic insight. And we'll catch you next time on Right on the Nail.